there's this constant balance between how we're using our attention. Things have gone so far towards things from the outside coming in. We're constantly demanding that of ourselves as opposed to just acknowledging that we get to just be.
That could be the unwanted distraction in our ears, on our screens, or in our heads. We've had experiences of profound silence when we're just so immersed in doing one thing. Turn deeply to silence, absorb the silence, find the answers in no thinking or talking.
Welcome to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast, where we meet the world's top experts to explore the secrets of health, mindset, longevity, and so much more. Are you ready to take charge of your existence and biohack your life? This show is for you. Please keep in mind, we're not dispensing medical advice and are not responsible for any outcomes you may experience from implementing the tactics lying herein. Are you ready? Let's do this. Welcome back to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. Okay, friends, you are in for a treat with today's episode. Even now, remembering recording this episode, I just get filled with such a sense of peace and calm and beauty. Reading Golden was a transformative experience. It really changed how I view the world and my experience of the world. And then having this interview, oh my goodness, you'll understand once you listen, which I realize is ironic because this is a show about silence, but you are just in for a treat. It's like a ride almost. We talk about things like what actually is silence, the shocking role of sound and silence in hospitals, the concept of having a right to attention, answering emails. Should you answer emails? Should you actually not send that email? The incredible story of Jarvis Masters, why maybe meditation isn't for everybody, what we can learn from libraries, the concept of the deepest silence you have ever known, and so much more. Lee and Justin are just beautiful souls. I cannot thank them enough for everything they are doing for our world and our planet, and I can't wait to hear what you guys think about this episode. The show notes will have a full transcript for this episode, as well as links to everything that we talked about, so definitely check that out. That will be at melanieavalon.com/golden. There will be two episode giveaways for this episode. One will be in my Facebook group, IF Biohackers, Intermittent Fasting plus Real Foods plus Life. Comment something you learned or something that resonated with you on the pinned post to enter to win something that I love. And then check out my Instagram, find the Friday announcement post. And again, comment there to enter to win something that I love. Hi, friends. Did you know that one of our largest sources of toxic exposure each and every day is through our skincare and makeup? It is so frightening the effects these compounds can have on our health. So we put these products on to help us look better, and yet they actually can be aging us, contributing to health issues, fertility issues, thyroid issues, mood issues, and ready for something potentially even more shocking? A lot of these endocrine disruptors are actually obesogens, meaning they cause your body to gain weight and make it harder to lose weight. That's right, your skincare and makeup may be hindering your weight loss goals. Europe has banned thousands of these compounds, and the US has banned around a dozen. There's even a loophole from the 1960s that allows companies to put whatever they want in their products, and they don't even have to tell you. That's why I am overwhelmingly careful about the skincare and makeup that I use. But here's the thing, it can be hard to find skincare and makeup that is non-toxic and actually works. And then on top of that, that actually has all the products you need. I have found two companies, I am obsessed with their standards and use them every single day of my life and cannot recommend them enough. That's Counter, formerly known as Beauty Counter, and Crunchy. Both of these companies have incredible standards when it comes to what they put in their products. You can truly feel good about using them and they actually work. For Counter products, go to melanieavalon.com/counter. And for Crunchy products, go to crunchy.com. That's crunchy.com/melanieavalon. New Crunchy customers can use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 to get 10% off. You'll also receive something special from me after your first order. I also highly recommend joining both of their loyalty programs. It's completely free to join, and with every purchase, you'll earn credit as well as other fun goodies. For all the latest updates, new products, specials, deals, and fun things for me, because yes, I love giving things away, get on my email list. That's at melanieavalon.com. melanieavalon.com/cleanbeauty. You can also get text updates when you text skincare to 877-861-8318. That's skincare to 877-861-8318. So again, to shop with me and get a free gift from me after your first order, go to melanieavalon.com/counter and also crunchy.com/melanieavalon. And new customers use the coupon code ADVOCATE10 at Crunchy to get 10% off site-wide. And again, definitely join their free loyalty programs to earn credit on every order. Hi friends, exciting news. My Avalon X Spirulina is back in stock and now at a reduced price. Plus you get free shipping and my coupon code works on top of that sale price. Spirulina is honestly one of the most nutrient-dense things that you can put in your body in a whole foods, easy to eat form. It's a blue-green algae, which is a complete vegan protein packed with an incredible array of nutrients. We are talking 100% of your daily hard-to-get vitamin K, 625% of vitamin B12, over 1,000% of vitamin A, 86% of chromium, 27% of vitamin B2, plus so much more, including iron, GLA, the powerful antioxidant superoxide dismutase, and even glutathione. In fact, spirulina is so uniquely nutritious that it was actually studied by NASA to support the astronauts. I searched high and low to find the very best spirulina out there. Ours comes from a wonderful, sustainable, clean, environmentally friendly production facility in Hawaii. Not Thailand, Hawaii. And then on top of that, we did our own third-party testing for over 70 pesticides, heavy metals, toxins, all the things. This is the cleanest spirulina out there. And with spirulina, you can simplify your supplement routine and support your nutrition in one easy step. The tablets are super versatile. You can swallow them whole, blend them into smoothies, crush them up, or honestly, just eat them like I do. And again, we were out of stock, but now Avalon X Spirulina is finally back in stock at a reduced price, and my coupon code MelanieAvalon works on top of that too. Plus, you get free shipping. Just go to avalonx.us/spirulina and use the coupon code MelanieAvalon to get 10% off our new reduced price plus free shipping. That's avalonx.us/spirulina with the coupon code MelanieAvalon. All right, without further ado, please enjoy this wonderful conversation with Justin Zorn and Lee Mars. Hi, friends. Welcome back to the show. I am so incredibly excited about the conversation that I am about to have. It is about a very unique topic, something, well, it overlaps with topics that I've talked about on this show as far as mental health and wellness and mindfulness and meditation and finding peace in life, but it's much more specific than that. And it's something that I think the audience will really, really resonate with, which is the concept of silence. And so what's really interesting leading up to this conversation. So I'm trying to remember how I was exposed to this. It was probably the author's publisher or agent or something, but I got the pitch about the book. The title of the book is Golden, The Power of Silence in a World of Noise. And I was just an immediate yes, because this is right up my alley. I can't wait to read this book. The cover of it was gorgeous as well. What's funny though is the book that I read right before reading this book was called Sentient by Jackie Higgins. And it was all about our senses. So it was all about sensing sound and other things. So it was really interesting to go from that book, which was all about, you know, our senses, to Golden, which was about silence, sort of the opposite of our senses. But I think it's going to be more nuanced than that. Like we'll talk about in today's conversation about what silence really is and what do we actually mean by that. But listeners, I will just say that reading this book, first of all, it's a beautiful book. It's very expansive. And I am using that word very specifically, but it's very expansive. It covers so many aspects of what is silence, what is noise, how does that manifest in today's modern world? How does it appear in culture? How does it appear in different people's lives? The science of it, how does it affect our brain? How does it affect policy and, you know, productivity and work culture and just so many things. And it personally has had a very profound effect on my life, which I'm sure I'll talk about later. I've had a major reframe from reading this book that has affected me daily, literally daily. I just am so excited to be here today with the authors. Yes, the authors. So I have two people on today's show. I'm here with Justin Zorn and Lee Mars. Thank you guys both so much, first of all, for writing the book. It's incredible. I can't wait to talk to you all about it. And also for your time and for being here. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Oh, thank you so much for those kind words, Melanie. We're super happy to be here.
Thanks so much for having us, Melanie. Really good to be with you.
For listeners, it's funny. Right before this, we were having some technical difficulties trying to get all of the sound going, which is kind of appropriate for, you know, this being a whole conversation about sound. But so to start things off, I normally ask about the author's personal stories. But Lee, you had a request, which I really, really like this, to start things off, to read a part of the opening of the book to kind of just give the audience a sense of what's going on here.
That sounds great. Thank you so much. Yeah, you may hear some pages turning, but that'll add to the ambiance, perhaps.
It's like being there. I love it.
So chapter one, an invitation. What's the deepest silence you've ever known? You can trust the first memory that comes to you. No need to overthink it. As you remember the experience, see if you can settle into it. Recall where you are, what's happening around you, and who, if anyone, is present. See if you can summon the atmosphere, the quality of light, the mood in the air, the feeling in your body. Is it quiet to the ears? Or is it the kind of silence that comes when no person or thing is laying claim on your attention? Is it quiet in your nerves? Or is it the kind of silence that lives deeper still, like when the turbulent waters of internal chatter suddenly part, revealing a clear path forward? Take a moment to consider what might sound like a strange question. Is the silence simply the absence of noise? Or is it also a presence unto itself?
I almost don't want to break the silence. That was amazing. And I'm having flashbacks now to when I first read that, because what I really loved about that opening to the book was it immediately pulls you into it and makes you actually viscerally experience what you talk about throughout the book. Because I have my answer for what happened when I did that exercise.
Oh, we'd love to hear your answer if you want to. I mean, share. We could all share our answers. Yeah.
That's such a good place to start, Melanie, with your reflections on it. What comes up for you?
So for me, and what I love about when you ask the reader to do that, because I have the tendency to like overthink things. And then you reassure us that it's just the first thing really that comes to your mind. For me, it's a few different things, but it's always been between words when talking to somebody and eagerly anticipating or wondering what they're about to say. Mostly it's been like in romantic relationships. but the specific memories I was thinking of were on phone calls with a certain person, and just a few key moments where there was a question asked and then there was an answer, and just that eternity of silence between the question and the answer. That was it for me. Yeah. I'm super curious, since you both have been writing this book, you know, and thinking about this so long, did you have that? Like for me, I read this book, I never really contemplated that question. So I had a very fresh, unbiased answer. But you guys have been so immersed in this. Like, are you able to answer that as if you've just been asked it for the first time? Or has your world been so immersed in this that you just have, you know, a laundry list of answers for it?
That's a really cool question. Because, you know, writing this book has been like signing up for a curriculum in like the study of noise and the study of silence. So it's changed, for at least for me, my understanding of the meaning of silence. Like one thing we explore in the book is that the most profound silence isn't even always auditorily quiet. You know, it's not always the absence of all sound and stimulus, but it's the absence of noise. It's the absence of anything making claims on the consciousness. So sometimes, you know, for us, I think for both of us, we've had experiences of profound silence when we're just so immersed in doing one thing. That could be on a crowded dance floor or, you know, running the perfect line through roaring rapids. It's not always what we expected. You know, for me, I write in a book about a moment of deep silence when my wife and I have twins and they were born just before the lockdowns in 2020 and had to spend a little bit of time in the newborn intensive care unit because they were born early, thankfully healthy, but it was a stressful time. And having a moment of just holding the two of them skin to skin in my chest amid all the nervousness and rumination and sounds of beeping bells in that hospital room, like just having this moment of such deep connection together where it was like nothing else was real, no other noise could penetrate.
It's so beautiful. How about you, Lee?
I appreciate so much your words that the opening words bring you into the visceral experience, because that's, I think, one of the big takeaways we got is that there's a big difference between what we might think the answer to this question could be when we conceptualize silence, that it's, you know, did it look a certain way and maybe be pristine, quiet in that auditory sense, or maybe be alone. But really what we found in asking all these fascinating characters, neuroscientists, politicians, artists, a whirling dervish, a man incarcerated on death row, and many, many more, this question and asking ourselves this question, is that it was really surprising. And that's really what gave the shape to this book. So my answer to that question, the one that wanted to be shared in this book, felt a little like that can't possibly be it. But the deepest silence I'd ever known also happened after the birth of my child. And it was at a time when I was in a cacophonous internal state of a postpartum psychosis. So many, many voices internally, unhelpful voices, we'll just summarize them as that, were going on yammering and clawing for the mic and the attention and the spotlight. But at a certain moment, I was asked a question, a really serious question from a psychiatrist who I think was trying to discern, like, what is the course of action with this woman? How far gone is she? What do we need to do to bring her back? He asked me if I'd ever lost my witness. And when he asked that question, immediately all those voices parted. And what became clear to me is I just had this incredible sense of discernment, this ability to discern what was true. And my answer was yes, but only once. And in that moment, I could feel something holding me, a presence that I would call silence, this quietening of that, of all that yammering, but also something bigger holding me throughout that chaotic experience. And it told me that I would be okay. And I wouldn't need to be hospitalized. And my relationship with my daughter would be beautiful. And it is 17 years later. And then my marriage would endure. And all these things were communicated in just like that. And that's the power of silence, is that it's separate from time. It's, you know, and separate from space. And we get transformed in those moments.
It's so interesting, because the way we all now have described our experiences, it's interesting that it seems to be both a absence, so an absence of noise, and a presence, which is hard to hold both of those at the same time. Where have you guys landed then with defining silence and noise and sound? And you talk about that throughout the book, kind of the differences between those. Yeah. Where are you now with that?
It was really a journey. You know, we both felt this intuition around 2017, when we were both feeling pretty despondent about the state of the world, just the state of the discourse in the world and how people seem to be stressed out, ourselves included, the state of politics, the state of the environment. And we just didn't know how we could make change that would really be durable and effective. And we both felt this intuition, like, look to the silence. Not just get beyond the noise, but turn deeply to silence, absorb the silence, find the answers in no thinking or talking. So we wrote an article for Harvard Business Review about this. And at the time, we were still thinking about the definition of silence really as mostly, you know, the absence of sound and stimulus. the article did really well. It really got a lot of people's attention, to our surprise, because we thought it was a little bit out there writing about silence in Harvard Business Review. And, you know, as Lee mentioned, we followed the cookie crumbs and started interviewing this cast of characters about this question, starting with this question: what's the deepest silence you've ever known? And, you know, the definition of silence started to emerge through these answers, really. I mean, particularly in talking with academic psychologists and neuroscientists, people who've studied the brain and human cognition and the nervous system deeply, we first came to an understanding that noise is unwanted distraction. You know, and that could be at the auditory level, it could be at the informational level, or it could be at the internal level, which is to say that could be the unwanted distraction in our ears, on our screens, or where we take in information, or it could be the unwanted distraction in our heads. So auditory, informational, and internal. And we gathered a lot of research that we can get into, if you'd like, Melanie, about how all of these levels of noise are on the rise, like in some cases, exponentially on the rise in our world today. And then we came to this understanding that silence isn't just the absence of noise. Like, it is at one level, it's the space where, like, no one is making claims on your consciousness, the place where no one is interfering with your perception or your intention. And then, as you alluded to, there's this deeper level of silence that's a presence unto itself, this state of not knowing, this state from which inspiration and creativity, and even in some cases, a kind of healing can emerge.
One of the most freeing things I think you talk about early in the book is how with noise and silence, just this idea that you don't have to have a responsibility to say something. And that is just so, so freeing. That's freeing. And then also on the noise perspective, it's really interesting how, because you use the word unwanted. So it really is relative. Something that's noise to me might not be noise to you. Like you guys talk about that, the leaf blower example, like somebody mowing somebody's lawn.
Yeah, this acoustic. Do you remember his name, Justin, right off? Shankar? Yeah. He said that noise is when someone, your neighbor, is mowing their lawn, and sound is when you're mowing your own lawn, and music is when your neighbor is mowing your lawn. So it is very much relative, we point out. And we're trying to make a distinction here between noise that is auditory versus sound, with, you know, or even music, or all those kinds of expressions that we love so much, or information in a neutral way. We would describe it as data. Data is, you know, good. There's nothing, or it's neutral, you know, but the unwanted information grabbing for our attention and the mass proliferation of that information available to us, regardless of the quality, is part of what we're noticing in terms of how that's affecting our attention levels. And then internally, you know, internal, that's thought, and we love thought, but chatter and that destructive kind of internal thought of rumination and fixation, that which Ethan Cross, a professor of University of Michigan, estimates, we listen to something like 320 State of the Union addresses of internal compressed speech every day. So, and a lot of that is very destructive. So we're looking at the toll of these. When it becomes unwanted distraction, it's no longer sound and data and thought, it's noise. On any of these fronts.
I am so fascinated by all of this, especially the informational processing bit, no pun intended, because you say in the book that, so to understand a person speaking, it takes 60 bits of information per second, but then we have an upper limit of around 126 bits. So what are we actually exposed to today with information? And what's really interesting, they often say, like, our brain, that we only use 10% of our brain, which makes it seem like we would be fine with all of this exposure to information. But is that the case? Do we actually have a limit? Does it saturate our brain?
It's a super interesting question, because, you know, if we only use a limited portion of our brain, it seems like, you know, now that we're dealing with at least five times as much information as we did a generation ago in the 80s, it seems like, well, hey, can't we just use more of our brain to absorb more of the information that, like, you know, constant social media exposure and GPT-4 and whatever it might be that's like providing this like limitless fire hose of information. But researchers on this, like Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, who is famous for his writing about flow, the researchers in the science of attention and the mind have found that over millennia, there's really not evidence that human beings can absorb any more information. We keep running into that upper limit that you described. You know, so we can find, you know, different hacks for being able to manage information of our lives. But in terms of our actual attention, you know, like there's this way Csikszentmihalyi had described it that, like, you know, we may be living in a world of more and more connection to all these billions of people, but we can only understand one of them at a time.
I was thinking about how, like I mentioned earlier, reading Jackie's book, Sentient, about our senses. And what that really got me thinking about, because she talks about how we think we have like our basic senses, but really we might have 20 or 30 different senses. But also this concept that there's so much information that we're not even sensing because we don't have senses to sense it. So it really kind of goes back to, you know, what is our, I guess, our mind choosing to take in and to focus on. You mentioned the increase of information and data in today's world. Literally what that actually looks like with the sound aspect, and you mentioned your experience in the hospital. How is that manifesting, like noise-wise? Hospitals today, for example, how have they changed? Sirens, how have they changed? What is that actual experience like?
Yeah, we use sirens as a proxy indicator for how loud it really is getting, speaking again on the auditory decibel level. The estimates are that sirens, emergency sirens, which need to grab our attention. So that's a, I'll get back to this term, but a bottom-up attention grabbing thing. So it's from the outside, you know, in that needs to grab our attention. Well, that needs to be 6 times louder to get our attention. So that tells us our urban soundscapes are louder than they were, 6 times louder for those sirens to pierce it in the last 100 years, that is. And across Europe, we do a little better job measuring decibel levels, in especially in urban centers, but the World Health Organization estimates that about 65% of the population, about 450 million people, live with noise levels that are harmful or hazardous to our health. So there is a big toll. It's not just to the ears, really, to our cardiovascular systems. There's links to diabetes, there's links to sleep loss, which are pretty obvious, but now we know so much more about the downstream effects of loss of sleep. So there's a great toll on our ability to focus. So that's actually that top-down attention. That's where we put our focus. That's what we want to put our attention on. But with more and more things clamoring from the outside, whether it's a pop-up thing on our screen or beeping and buzzing in a different, in a hospital setting, there are all these alarms and sound bells, and you see why we'd need those with all the instrumentation, but there are so many of them that we now see our healthcare providers suffering from an alarm fatigue where that, you know, people just don't respond, or you can't even really tell which alarm is it. One cardiovascular, some kind of measurement of the cardiovascular system had 86 different sound notifications, 86 different alarms, and it would take a savant to understand one from the other. So we've just swung in this direction of sound and information as more information, as if it's always better. But as Justin pointed out, there's only so much we can take in and sort and discern. And there's a certain point where it becomes really quite damaging and tiring, exhausting, and unnecessary level to those workers and to those of us staying in the hospitals.
Hey friends, I am about to tell you how to get 10% off the ideal coffee when it comes to supporting your health. So if you guys know me, you know I am obsessed with optimizing basically everything I consume, and that especially relates to coffee. Did you know that coffee is one of the most powerful sources of antioxidants in the modern diet? And yet, not all coffee is created equal. Between sourcing, farming practices, roasting, and contaminants, there can be a huge difference in the health impact of the coffee that you drink. That is exactly why I created Glow Coffee. Glow Coffee is a premium, specialty-grade Arabica coffee sourced from sustainable women-led farms in Colombia. It's organically grown, and we third-party test it meticulously, like every single lot, for purity. And what makes Glow especially exciting from a biohacking perspective is that we specifically made it to be rich in chlorogenic acid, or CGA. That's one of coffee's primary, most potent antioxidant compounds that has been studied for its role in metabolic health, inflammation, oxidative stress, and so much more. The elevation levels of the beans, how they're grown, and how they're roasted all affect CGA levels. So we searched high and low to find the perfect beans naturally high in CGA and tested them to confirm that, and then we roast those beans to preserve the CGA content. And then test after that as well. Coffee is already one of the potentially biggest contributors of antioxidants in the human diet, so I designed Glow Coffee to maximize those benefits while keeping it incredibly clean and high quality. And this coffee is so clean. It's grown organically, of course, but then we go even farther than that. We third-party test the beans for almost 100 toxic compounds, including pesticides, heavy metals, and mold. Oh, and perhaps the best part is it is absolutely delicious. We're talking smooth, low bitterness. It's honestly the exact coffee I personally want to drink every single day of my life. It's so bright, smooth, and delicious that it's also perfect black for fasting. No added sweeteners or cream needed. You can also splash it on your face for an antioxidant-rich toner. I do that every single day. After the sauna, after the shower, all the things. I created Glow Coffee because it's really about upgrading one of our most common daily habits into something that truly supports your health and performance. You can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. That's 10% off Glow Coffee with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at glowcoffeeco.com. Are you ready to glow inside and out? Fuel your day, illuminate your way. That's glowcoffeeco.com. So it's so funny. The book I was reading last night is about AI and the future of healthcare specifically. And he was talking about the future of the hospital and how great it was because they're going to be able to start monitoring all of these things and there will be all of these alerts for different things. And I was like, oh no, this is not good. So when I interview him, I'm going to ask him about this.
You just got me thinking, like, this gets to such a core message of the book. Like, you know, hearing about some of these devices within intensive care units that get to decibel levels that are like harmful as understood by the World Health Organization and by others. It's like one of the key themes that we uncovered in all this research is that we just don't really think so much about the costs and benefits of all the noise we create. Like, we're talking about hospitals here, but like, it's also like group emails. You know, Cal Newport, the computer scientist and productivity expert guru, writes a lot about what he calls convenience addiction. Like, we just assume that group emails are always the way to go in an office setting because, you know, any possible information that's useful to just one person outweighs the distraction to all those other people. Like, there's not really a cost-benefit analysis as to what the unwanted distraction, you know, causes in terms of consequence. I'm like, that applies across society writ large. You know, whether that's like the impact of a, you know, of a low decibel, high frequency hum of a data center that like causes people headaches, but produces some economic development, you know, or that example of the ringing bells in a hospital treatment room or an ICU. It's like, we have to think about the cost benefit. And to do that, we get into some of the science of like what literal auditory noise actually costs us, going back to what Florence Nightingale discovered 150 years ago, or discovering what cognitive scientists are finding about our ability to concentrate today. So that whole like AI in the hospital example, like, yeah, there could be access to a lot more valuable information that can in some cases be life-saving or cut the amount of time doctors have to spend or nurses have to spend on routine tasks. And then there's also this like way that like the excessive surplus of information can create, as Herb Simon, the scholar in the 1970s put it, that surplus of attention can create a poverty of attention.
So many different things here. Well, so first of all, so is there a solution to that? Because, I mean, especially being in this biohacking sphere, I'm reading stuff all the time about how we're going to be monitoring so many things, and all it's all about the data, like all the data. And one of the benefits of AI is that, you know, as humans, we could never take in all that data and analyze it, but AI can. So it can take it all in and it can do all, it can figure out what's going on. What would be the solution there? Would the solution be AI that takes it all in and also can be really selective in what it actually tells us at the end? Like, I just don't know how to actually practically, well, not me, but the world can practically get all of this data and get what we need from it without creating this overload of information.
Yeah. I can see the prospects for AI, you know, reducing the amount of information that we have to take in. But I could also see the like specter of it creating a whole lot more noise. You know, we were speaking with a friend recently about how for her, the noise is like all the agendas coming at her. Like, you know, so much of the information that's coming at her, whether it's on TV or on social media or even just overhearing things out in the world, it's like not so much just the sound and stimulus of it, but it feels like noise to her because there's so many different agendas at play. Like people, as we describe it, like making claims in your consciousness, like having something that they're trying to convince you to do. And one of the problems with AI is it's kind of, you know, it provides a large language model, provides this like, you know, organized mashup of what's on the internet already. But people are putting things on the internet for like various agendas, various things they're trying to convince people of. So like it might not necessarily reduce the number of claims it's putting on the consciousness. And it's like for us in this exploration, irrespective of what technologies come forward, like irrespective of what AI looks like, what the Internet of Things look like, what Web 3.0 or whatever the new wave of innovation looks like what really matters is what we value as people, as a society. And is that value just the maximum possible production of mental stuff? Is it just more and more information for information's sake? Is it more and more speed and movement and the quickness of the computation? Or do we value the spaces of stillness? Do we value the uninterrupted time in nature or uninterrupted time where we could give our full attention to our kids? Do we value pristine attention? Because that's what silence is for us. It's pristine attention.
Going back to the opening when I said my deepest moment of silence was like, you know, waiting for the answer. And I think that's because it was pristine attention. Like it's the ultimate not knowing the answer. So it's just waiting and focusing for that, you know, that answer. And I think that's why it manifested as so much silence for me. I know for me, one of the most freeing things has been I don't use any notifications on my phone for like nothing is allowed, like no sounds, no alerts, no anything. I remember one time during one of the updates for the phone, you could, when it was for the do not disturb mode, but then it would give you an alert saying it was in the do not disturb mode. And I was like, what is the point? like, no, I don't want anything. But speaking to that, so two things. One, you talk about this in the book, but you talk about how from an evolutionary perspective, we actually, you know, we get a dopamine hit from information seeking. Like it's like the one thing that's not technically a survival thing. Like it's not food or shelter or sex, which would be, I guess, furthering the species. But we seek information and we get that same dopamine hit from it. And I know I experience that all the time. I love learning and all of that, but I just, when you're scrolling through all the content and social media, like you just want to take it in and it just never ends. A question about that, because you keep talking about things making claims to our attention and our right to attention. And I was thinking about that. So is that a right? What determines a right to attention? Like if somebody creates content, how is that impeding on my rights? Or is it just when they come into my sphere? So like on my phone, my TV, my internet, where is the rights aspect coming from?
Well, I mentioned the top down, bottom up. So this seems like a good time to break that down. So this is building on the work of Adam Ghazali and Larry Rosen. They're a neuroscientist, psychologist duo. And they break these apart. So top down attention, that's what we want to focus on. That's what we're having this conversation. My top down attention is on our conversation. That's where my intention is. Now, if I'd left all my notifications on and my family was out there calling my name and my phone was ringing and all these other things on, that would be bottom up attention. That's the stuff that kind of gets your attention. And we need that for survival. Larry Rosen and Adam Ghazali point out, like, we can't just be focused on what we want all the time. You know, we need to know the saber-toothed tiger is coming out of the woods. We need to know that a tree branch is falling. We need to know when someone calls out our name. So there's this constant balance between how we're using our attention. The problem is things have gone so far towards bottom-up attention, things from the outside coming in, crashing in, and that's actually a function, you know, so that balancing is part of our ancient brains doing what it's meant to do. We are driven to find information. We're information-seeking creatures. So we're doing a combination of those for our survival. But currently, with all this bottom-up stuff coming at us, it's being taxed to an unprecedented degree. And all the neuroscientists we spoke with, Judson Brewer and Katie Devaney and others, are deeply concerned about what is it like to have that constantly being exploited, that ancient brain survival mechanism being exploited like that. We don't know the answer to that. But the fact that we are having trouble with it is really, I mean, this is our brains doing what it's done for forever, seeking information, intending our attention, but keeping our attention open to outside things. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. I had heard before that one of the issues with alerts and notifications is because it's like the equivalent. So like if you see that you have a text or message and you see that little number, it's the equivalent of evolutionarily like being tapped on the back or hearing a sound. You don't know what it is. Like you don't know if it's a threat or something good. So when you see that notification, it's like the survival response. You have to check it because you don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm. Totally. That relates to, you know, what we were talking about earlier. Just briefly, I mentioned Florence Nightingale, how 150 years ago, she was stationed in Turkey during the Crimean War, and she was made responsible for a British army hospital. And the conditions in the hospital, Melanie, were like so bad, like gangrenous wounds going unattended. And among the conditions she cited as most important to deal with was noise, which sounded crazy at the time. But she called noise the most cruel absence of care that could be inflicted on sick or well. And she talked about different kinds of noise. And like what you just talked about with phone notifications really linked directly to one particular part, which is that she said the most pernicious kind of noise was the kind of noise that was like a conversation just out of earshot that left the mind racing, left the mind perseverating on what was said. And it's like, yeah, when we're in the middle of doing something and we get a text message ding, or we get a notice that someone responded to something we posted on social media, that's like exactly the kind of thing that she was describing. And to what Lee was just saying about the impacts of that, you know, what we now know is that she was describing the activation of the fight or flight response, which has real implications for cortisol in the body and our wellness across so many different dimensions. So it's like, you know, this idea of like a right to attention, a right to quiet, you know, we look at this in different ways. Like there's some law review articles that have been written about the idea of a right to our attention and what it would mean to have the right to not be spammed and so on and so forth in the digital sphere. And also what it means in terms of like the right to an 8-hour workday. And in France, there's been movement to create a right to unplug, you know, a right to not have to, you know, be tethered to our devices after hours. So like, as we think about rights, you know, I've worked in politics for quite a while. I was a congressional staffer for a while in DC. And, You know, often when we think about the idea of like a right to healthcare or a right that would be a rallying cry, like it was often an art more than a science. Like it's a mobilization tool to talk about rights. And it can be something that we can work through law to make something real. But like oftentimes this idea, like a right to attention, is often about like creating this cultural shift in our values so that we honor that something's important. We honor that pristine attention's important. And we honor that we need the space in our lives to do things, to practice what you were talking about before, Melanie, with like exercising choice in our lives rather than just like doing what the algorithms in our phone or our email inbox is pointing us to. So like, how can we find different policies and also different personal practices, family practices, community practices to like make that right more real?
Two things specifically I've done going back to the notifications thing. So when I'm winding down at night, I turn off all social media. I would at least like look and see if I had messages, but I wouldn't read them. But now I just don't open Instagram, don't open Facebook, because if I see again that, you know, there's, oh, I have these messages, then it's like I'm engaging that whole network, which we can get into the network stuff later. Also with emails. Okay, so maybe you can help me with this, because this is something that I've struggled with. You guys mentioned Nir Eyal, who I've had on the show as well. And he talks about the role of email. That was your book, right? You talk about him and email, answering email? Or am I misattributing?
Yeah, we do a little bit. I think we mentioned him somewhere.
Yeah, he talks about shifting. Yeah, like we're shifting our attention like every 19 seconds and spending an hour getting back to whatever it is we're doing from all that interruptions. I think we just touch on his work a little bit, but go ahead.
I swear everybody mentions his work. So I was like, oh, wait, maybe it actually wasn't this book. So with email, for example, because one of the exercises you talk about, I think it's the exercise about finding silence with friends and family. And the first step is actually looking at yourself and how are you contributing to the noise. And so even going back to like the email example that we were talking about with all of the emails that are sent. So historically, I've always tried to answer every email. I remember when I was interning in college at one point, a film production company, and the assistant said, with email, if you get an email, always err on the side of answering if you're on the fence. I was like, oh, okay, always answer. And I feel like for me with email, I feel like I need to acknowledge people. So like if they send me an email that could or could not have an answer, I want to like tell them that they were heard and that they were seen. So for me, it comes from a place of like valuing the person. That really, I think, is where it comes from me. Like I feel rude if I don't send a confirmation that I got their email. But on the flip side, you could see it as actually just contributing to more of the data and the information. Like I could not send that last like thanks email. So this is a very specific question, but how do you guys engage with that with email? Like if you get like an email where the conversation could be over, or you could send like a final thanks, do you send the thanks?
I love this question.
You go ahead, Justin.
No, I love this question because it's a little thing, Melanie, and it gets to like such a big theme that we explored in a deep way in the book. You know, we don't want to give the impression that we're like against sound and stimulus and like, don't answer your emails, don't practice politeness. You know, we don't want people to run away to a monastery. Like we don't want people to leave their lives behind and go seek deep silence. So like the stories we explore in this book are like, you know, how can we have conscientiousness in our lives? How can we show up for our responsibilities? You know, like bringing that extra courtesy to emails and being responsive, but to do so in a way that like still leaves space for deep, immersive, renewing silence in our lives. So for me, like this whole question of why silence is so uncomfortable, like why silence is so scary. We have a chapter in the book called Why Silence is Scary. Like we get into a bunch of deep reasons about the, you know, what Nietzsche called the horror of the vacuum, and how in a recent study, like a bunch of undergraduates at the University of Virginia would rather like receive a painful electric shock than sit without their phones in silence for 15 minutes. Like there's this like deep, deep wiring we have to find silence uncomfortable or even scary. But what you're describing, Melanie, with the email and like getting back to people and meeting our social obligations, being a kind person, being an attentive person, is like one reason that silence is uncomfortable or even scary is that it means that we're not fulfilling our responsibilities. You know, it means at some level the FOMO arises, like we're missing something. We're missing some information, but we're also missing some way that we're supposed to be showing up to feed our family, or we're missing some way that we're supposed to be showing up to be a kind person. And like for us, we think it's possible within this world in which we're now living, like it is possible to find a balance. Yeah, we need to make some structural changes to deal with the noise, but it's also possible as individuals to learn how to navigate the noise and find these pockets of immersive silence.
I love this.
You'll notice, you know this from reading the book so closely, that we're not very prescriptive in the book. We're really offering a bunch of ideas to kind of spark what's true. So I love this sparked with you. Having just received a little back and forth thanks, I want you to know the impact over here was warming because we were just getting to know each other. So I love that you wrote that extra email, you know, that your value comes through. And that's part of it, is just that we just need to keep attuned to what it is that we're here trying to, you know, be in the world, do in the world, tune into in the world. What is the impact? You know, we're, it's hard for us to tell sometimes our own noise and our own quiet, you know, where we're contributing to what. So sometimes we have to ask truth tellers in our lives, people we work with, and just kind of get a little bit of their take on things. Maybe sometimes we have to try, well, what's the difference? How do I feel in my body? Now I'm writing this thank you, but it's from sort of an obligatory place versus that spacious, warming place. You know, we might have to pay attention to the signals in our own bodies and our own relationships and the tasks in order to tell what's true in this case.
This is just so incredible. And like you said, I know it's a very specific example, but I think it's a good example of consciously addressing. And like, I'm just brainstorming right now. I have two options I'm going to like think about later. So one, maybe for people that I'm interacting with all the time, like my business partners, my assistants, maybe I'll just have like a conversation with them where I tell them I'm going to like stop sending those final thanks. And it's not because I'm not thankful. It's because I don't want to contribute to the information overload.
Right. Assume gratitude, coworkers, you know, assume my gratitude. I can express it at a different time. That's exactly what we say, is like have a conversation. This is the irony here, is we're talking about silence and quiet and spaciousness, but we might actually need to have a conversation about that in order to create the space where it doesn't feel awkward. Like Justin was describing, it's not misunderstood. It's nice and clear and appreciated for what it's intended to do.
Hi friends. Would you like to have the most epic eating experience? I'm talking eradicate bloating and better absorb your nutrients. If so, you need digestive enzymes. These are one of my most favorite supplements out of everything I take, and I truly cannot imagine my life without them. Digestive enzymes are key to break down your food into usable nutrition and to stop things like bloating, digestive distress, constipation, all the things. That's why I created Avalon X Digest. And you can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at avalonx.us. You can also get a subscription and save 15%, which you can pause or cancel at any time. Friends, I worked so hard to create the perfect blend of enzymes for Avalon X Digest. It's a full-spectrum, plant-based enzyme blend with proteases to help you break down protein, amylase for carbs, lipase for fats, cellulase for fiber, and so much more. In fact, there are 13 different types of enzymes in this blend. I cannot tell you how many people have told me that when they take Avalon X Digest, they experience no digestive distress with meals. These are truly game changers. And for any of you guys looking to up your protein intake, Avalon X Digest will help you actually break down and assimilate your protein so you get more protein from your meals. I wanted to create the highest potency enzymes so that you get all of these benefits when you eat with no problematic fillers or ingredients. Avalon X Digest is also tested multiple times for purity and potency, comes in glass bottles, and is truly the best enzymes on the market. And again, you can get 10% off with the coupon code MelanieAvalon at avalonx.us. Exactly. And then maybe I can do something fun with my email signature that will like talk about this. I'm going to contemplate this.
That's cool. I love that experimental mindset you got going.
That was one thing I love about the book as well. Like at the end, you have this nice recap. It's like 33 ways to find silence. And there's all of these different things that you can try. And that's what I really liked is it's really, you know, it's so much about the individual. A, what we were talking about earlier about your perspective of what is noise and sound and silence. And then B, all of these potential things that you can experiment with to find silence in your daily life, find it with others. It's like there's a whole toolbox of things that, you know, people can try. So Justin, you mentioned scary and fear. And Lee, you mentioned the word awkward. I would love to talk about this concept about why does silence relate to fear? And then in particular, you talk about the different octaves of fear. So, you know, like a lower octave of fear, which might have a negative effect on our constitution compared to a higher, you know, octave, which is associated with awe and religion and wonder. So fear and awkwardness, which also there's like awkward silences. So what's happening with all of that?
Yeah, this was a chapter of the book that like emerged as we were having conversations with people. And we realized this was a persistent theme. Like, you know, we hear about awkward silence, but silence is something more than awkward sometimes. If you're the idea of spending a lot of time in silence, like that UVA study I mentioned about the students who preferred electric shocks to silence, to time away from the phones, like sometimes it's like this urge to run away. And we do this kind of thought experiment, this feeling experiment at the beginning of that chapter. Like imagine you just committed the next 5 years of your life to being in total silence. Like no worries about how you're going to earn a living, take care of loved ones. Everything's been taken care of. What's your first thought?
Literally for me right now, I was like, oh my, oh, that's a lot. That would be a lot to take on. I don't think I could do it.
It's like, you know, it's so far away from our reality right now. And it's not something that we like recommend anyone do. But we mention it because, you know, we bring this thought experiment forward because Pythagoras, who was like one of the great philosophers in history, who influenced so much of the rest of Greek philosophy and invented all these mathematical and geometric concepts and various scientific and musical concepts and theories that are still in use today, 2,500 years ago, he required his inner circle of students to spend 5 years in silence, to spend 5 years not talking.
Did they really do that? I don't normally interrupt. When I read that, when I read that in the book, I was like, did they do that? Really?
It's documented in a few places that that was a requirement that he had for his students. And it's like, this is 2,500 years ago to study with one of the greatest geniuses in all of history, like as part of this mystery school that wasn't just like a scientific school as we think about it today. It was also a spiritual school. Like this was the requirement he put on his students as we've studied in our research. That's what we found. And like, we just wanted to understand, like, you know, irrespective of whether anyone's actually going to do this, like it seems a little unbelievable in today's world, but like, what would that do to the architecture of consciousness? Like, what would that do to the makeup of your mind? And in this chapter, we explore, like through conversations and studies, how like we have to pass through these stages of fear and like crazy thoughts and like restlessness in order to encounter a kind of wholeness. And we look at this not just in terms of like ancient philosophy, we look at it also in terms of the modern science of psychedelics and what happens in states of like deep rapturous silence where that can sometimes be really frightening. And like how, you know, you've got to like peel layers of the onion and like get closer to the core, get to the center point where it's possible to have these higher states of insight.
Wow. I'm just thinking now, so in society, are there any rituals where things like this are implemented? I'm trying to think like growing up in school. I guess we did a prayer moment in classes in the beginning, like a moment of silence. How about on like Capitol Hill in politics?
You know, there's really not, as you'd imagine. I was involved in starting a meditation program at Capitol Hill with former Congressman Tim Ryan, who was in the news a lot recently for the really close Senate run. He had a meditation practice for some time, and I was involved with him in setting up a program on Capitol Hill where we had some members of Congress from both parties who would sometimes come to meditate. We had a lot of senior staffers, economists, and attorneys, and legislative directors and chiefs of staff and congressional offices who would come and meditate. I was a legislative director there on Capitol Hill for some years, and I was also a meditation teacher during that time. And it was such a cool experience because, you know, even though we think of this book as not like a book about meditation, we think of it as a kind of non-meditator's guide to getting beyond the noise. That experience I had teaching meditation on Capitol Hill was just like the power of what's possible by getting a room of really high-strung people saturated in noise together to be in silence for 20 minutes. Like the alchemy that can happen in that state.
And that is similar to, is it the Quakers that have the moment of silence before, or the Iroquois? Do they both do that?
The Quakers sit in silence actually quite regularly and for long periods of time. And we spoke with a birthright Quaker, Rob Lippincott, about that experience as their spiritual meetings and their meetings for the purpose of business are both held with a lot of silence, very similar in their structure. And there's a clerk in there who is really sensing what's happening in the meeting. Everyone has understood, especially with all this deep practice of silence, that the practice is to share that silence together and to speak only when what you have to say is worthy of breaking that silence, when it's really for the benefit of the whole and not coming from sort of an egoic place, say. So you speak when the spirit moves you and when it's worthy of breaking the silence. So sometimes, like, imagine these business meetings where that similar structure is happening. The clerk is sensing how the meeting is going, but there, you know, maybe there is a disagreement, even a heated one, where people start to get polarized in their conversations or rigid in their thinking and talking with one another. The clerk will call for silence. And Rob describes as sort of that meeting where there's a silence asked by the clerk, and everyone kind of just relaxes into that silence, being well versed in how to share silence. And that tension and that fire and the disagreement will soften, and someone in the room, he says, inevitably will say something that he was thinking, but better. And they'll find their way through. They're also not afraid of just like breaking for a while, or maybe not, you know, setting that disagreement down and coming back to it with more time and space in just life. You know, just maybe now is not the time to make this important decision, because we want our decisions to be enduring. We want them to really come from our highest place. So there's a lot of, actually, we can turn to all kinds of different tradition, spiritual, we talk in Jewish law, one who visits someone who's bereaved, who's grieving, is instructed to be silent, to not speak unless spoken to just hold that sacred space of silence for a mourner, to make it possible for them to be present in their grief and not engaged in small talk or even in any kind of talk that they don't want to be, and to not run the risk of trivializing that person's experience with well-intentioned but sometimes awkward words. So there are traditions to turn to. We talk about Nyepi, this annual day of silence. It's the peak in the Balinese calendar, a peak day, the new year, which is spent in silence with families going inward and being quiet, and not burning fires and not making noise. And even the internet and the cellular coverage is turned off for everyone to just contemplate their lives, their good fortunes, and this new year and their intentions for the year to come. So there are places to look. There are places where we believe in the arts, for example, as another place just in our day-to-day lives where we'll see the beautiful use of silence with music and concerts. And even when you've seen an incredible performance and there's just like that,
and you don't want to clap because it's just so, you don't want to break that feeling that we're sharing. We know how to do this. I think that's the point we want to really want to get across, is that this is an old technology. This is, you know, this isn't a hack. This is, we're born with this. This is an innate wisdom to being human together. And that we believe it's just worth putting our attention there and appreciating it for all it brings into our lives.
Did you find any data, at least in the US, on the most quiet and the loudest day each calendar year? Like, is Christmas the quietest?
No, I haven't seen any data on that. You know, there's different ways you could measure it, I think, according to how we study the meaning of noise and silence. You know, the auditory decibel levels in various places, which is just emerging. Some cities measure decibel levels. As Lee mentioned, you know, sirens are often used as a proxy. But then there's also questions like email traffic and that sort of thing, those measures of the informational noise. But it's hard to say. I mean, it is, you know, you mentioned Christmas and you know, there is sometimes a kind of feeling like the seasons bring with them different kinds of energies, different kinds of levels of sound and stimulus. But even if there's less activity and fewer people going to work around Christmas and New Year's, sometimes those times can also mean an increase in the internal noise. Sometimes those are times when people are, for example, navigating family dynamics and feeling a lot of ruminative thought. You know, so that's like one thing we really want to understand in this book. And, you know, to some degree, we use empirical research, you know, to understand. But like a lot of it needs to be subjective and personal, because a lot of this we can only understand for ourselves. Like these questions of how different feedback loops of noise work in our world, like how noise in one sphere begets noise in another sphere, and what we could do to understand those feedback loops so we could turn down the dial of volume.
Why do you think libraries are somewhere where we have agreed as a collective unity or as a community to honor silence? Like that's really the one place I can think of where you go in there and it's like, it's quiet and you feel like you're disrupting a social norm if you're loud in there.
Yeah, most certainly. And I just, you know, I'm doing a lot of touring with my daughter of university libraries, and they're often multiple layers, right? And what they'll tell us is like, oh, and it gets quieter the higher you go up in these buildings. So the norms, I think, sometimes are different on different floors. But what I love about that is that they're being discussed and that there are norms. There actually always are norms about silence and noise. They're usually just not discussed. It ends up being more of a default. So libraries are one of those where there's a norm and we all sort of know about it. But in our workplaces, there are norms for how often, like, do you expect an instant response to an instant message? If someone calls, you know, that, how does that go? You know, are all our meetings 60 minutes? Who talks and who doesn't? there's norms taking place. So our emphasis is if we can bring those norms, whatever they are, those defaults into the foreground and discuss them and actually choose them, then we can shape the culture that we want to have in, whether it's working together or in our family lives or in our friend groups or just with ourselves, where we have, of course, the most control over what we do with ourselves. So we look at our sphere of control in the book and really start bringing in some practices to where you have the most control in the center of the sphere. And then one notch out is where you might have some influence. And that's how it usually is with other people involved. And then where you don't have control, perhaps it's just too big of a topic or issue, or it's a short-term thing where you don't have control. How can you let it go or even embrace that, however briefly? Like that might be when your neighbor puts on their lawnmower and you, you know, just have to let it go, or just celebrate as soon as they're done. Celebrate the quiet that follows.
Is it possible, because you do talk about making friends with the noise, is it possible to, if it is all perspective, could you in theory reframe every noise and not have noise in your life?
There's a lot of research that suggests that really the context we have about the noise that's going on, for example, if there's flights, you know, air flight traffic is often, you know, a burden to many of us and has some real issues. But if we
if we hear that it's, oh, well, this is about fire management or something like that, you know, or there's some kind of, you know, reason behind it, then we will be in a better place with it. We'll be more accepting around that. And the main teacher in our book, Jarvis J. Masters, is on death row in San Quentin, as you know, for a crime, the preponderance of evidence, and we certainly believe he did not commit. So he is in this very loud environment. San Quentin's death row is cacophonous. It is auditorily loud. There's just cement and metal and keys and yelling men and lo-fi radios and party beats all the time, 24/7, and men screaming at night with night terrors and all kinds of things. That's the soundscape. Informationally, there's so much information regarding their different cases and appeals and things that can become very stressful in a whole other way. And then internally, there's the reverberations of trauma in that space. Most people who are in there have suffered from severe abuse and or a dysfunctional foster care system or any number of things. So there's a lot of noise, but Jarvis has learned to navigate that noise. And actually, to some degree, there's a certain amount of that noise that tells him things are going on as normal. And if it gets too quiet in that setting, it could signal that something is not good is happening, you know, whether it's about a raid that's coming, perhaps with the guards raiding their cells, or perhaps even something else going on between the different inmates. So there's a certain amount of noise he welcomes, and he loves the silence right beside that noise. So yeah, we've seen some incredible, I guess, teachers, you know, seen and heard and learned from teachers who are constantly working in these high volume hellscapes to find quiet, which goes to show you that we can, no matter what the circumstances, find at least a little bit more quiet for ourselves.
I loved reading about his story. How did you conduct that interview with him?
We did that by phone. He is able to call out. So I set up an account and he's able to call collect. We put money into it. And then we were able to record that conversation. We had many, many conversations, and I speak with him about once a week and go to see him at San Quentin's death row periodically, every few months. So he's become a really close friend for both of us. And we adore him and are doing all we can to help his appeal, which is right now being considered. So he could be released any moment now. His case is on a judge's desk for consideration right now.
Oh, wow. Does he do podcasts? I want to interview him so bad. I was reading. I was like, wow, he just sounds absolutely amazing.
He is amazing. He is. He does do some podcasts. I think he just today was on 10% happier. So it's a process, but so speaking of his meditation practice. So yeah, he's incredible.
I loved what you talked about with him about how he was in solitary confinement and then what happened when he was taken out of that, which you would think would be, you know, a good thing, but the effect that it had on his mental health and wellness was not good. What happened to him when that happened?
It was certainly what he wanted, is to move from solitary confinement. He was on solitary confinement, the AC, or Adjustment Center, for 22 years, longer than any person in the history of San Quentin had ever been. And he was moved to the East Block, where he gets a lot more freedoms, more time on the yard, more, you know, access to commissary and phone and things like that. So there were some definite, you know, this was the right direction to be heading in. But what he hadn't anticipated is that, and who would know this, moving from the AC to the East Block meant moving from a room with like all closed walls, and including that front door, to more mesh wire and openness and a lot more sound and stimulus. And that sound was so intense to his whole sensory channels that he had the most severe seizure he'd ever had in his life when he moved from one to the other. So it took a lot of adjusting, and he really had to amp up his own practice for getting quiet when he moved from the AC to the East Block.
You know, just reading about him was so powerful, and how he does work with the other inmates and helps bring silence into their lives as well. It was really, really powerful.
Yeah, as well as to our lives, actually, to Justin and I. I mean, he's a wonderful human here to help others to find quiet.
So amazing. It's really, really empowering. And going back to the beginning, the very, very beginning, I said that there was something from the book that had a profound daily effect on my own life. And it also relates to, I guess, empowering yourself. It's sort of I'll just say what it is. So you talk about multitasking, and we were talking earlier about our obsession with information, and there's this idea of productivity. You know, maybe we can talk about GDP, but basically, at least for me, the thing that drives me and what gives me worth and value, which is a whole nother topic, but I always need to feel productive. Like, I always want to be maximizing like every moment. So I always feel like when I'm doing something, I need to be doing as much as I can in that moment. So if I'm cleaning the kitchen or something, then I need to be listening to a podcast, or I need to be like listening to a book. Like, I actually get anxiety if I do something where I could capably do two things at once. So like I said, like cleaning the kitchen, something, you know, physical where I could be listening to a podcast or an audiobook at the same time. If I don't listen to an audiobook or podcast at that moment, I feel like I'm not being productive. Like, it's a quote, bad thing. And after reading your book, I have completely reframed that. I'm still working on it. It's still hard. I feel the trigger. I feel the anxiety. But now when I do things in my daily life, I'm like, oh, I can actually not listen to something right now. And not only is that okay, it actually could be a really great thing in my life, taking in more of these present moments. So it's been a huge reframe for me. So I just want to thank you guys for that. It's had a very powerful daily effect.
Oh, that makes us so happy to hear that.
You know, Valerie, it's like I mentioned before that writing this book has been like signing up for a curriculum for us. And like, my wife is always pointing out the ways I'm like always doing that. And like, part of it is like, you know, Lee and I were both big talkers. Like, we enjoy sharing. We enjoy listening to stuff. We love, you know, being in the company of other people. And in some ways, the ideas we put forward in this book are counterintuitive for us in our lifestyles. And like, we wrote this in part knowing it's like what we need. And it's been like a curriculum for me, you know, almost exactly like you're describing, cleaning the kitchen and like being willing to get into the silence, or even just like making the space in my day to do what I know will change everything. If I can just put away my phone and go on a little walk or hike, like without the phone, and just connect to the rays of the sun and hear the breezes and the branches, like, I know it'll reset my nervous system and open a whole bunch of new possibilities for my day, improve my mood.
Mm. Yeah. There's so much here to just about really paying attention. And I think you did such a beautiful job that the tense, when you're feeling that tension of I'm washing the dishes, but I better cram this podcast in. I've got to, you know, be improving. And we're like, as Justin just confessed, we're guilty of the same. But to really notice when it's like that, when it's that contraction feeling, versus when maybe you're doing the exact same thing, but it feels expansive or somehow, you know, wonderful, like it is bringing you quiet. So this is why it's like never as simple as do and don't, but just to notice when it's feeling that like, oh, you're just stuffing it in from that place of contraction, or when you're really just expanding into something else and it feels nourishing. So I'm so happy to hear you say that, because it can be those of us who really strive for personal development, and we can sometimes get on a track of something that becomes a really quite, I don't know, almost brutal to the self, where we're constantly demanding that of ourselves, as opposed to just acknowledging that we get to just be, and that's enough.
It definitely feels expansive. Going back to that word visceral, I literally feel it. It feels really good to just do something. I keep using the kitchen example, but just to do something like that and just be in that moment and not, you know, be multitasking and doing other things. It feels very healthy. It feels very good. So like I said, I still get the anxiety trigger about it, but I just noticed that and, you know, continue to work on it. Is there something in both of your lives? Where do you most struggle now still to find the silence in a moment?
I have 3-year-old twins and a 6-year-old at home. So it's joyful and there's a lot of beautiful conversation and play and fun noises and sounds of toys and lots of things going on in our household. And for me, like, you know, being really engaged in my work, needing to find the time to take care of all the responsibilities around the house and for the kids, like, it's just a struggle for me sometimes to be able to find the time to step away from the sound and stimulus. So, like, one of the things that I've been working to do, something we lay out in the book, which is like how to focus not so much on the quantity of the silence, but the quality. Like, if I only have 3 minutes to step outside into the backyard or out in front of the house or to a quiet room, like, rather than saying, all right, I need an hour break or I need to really just get away from it all, can I focus on delving as deeply as I can, finding the most immersive silence that I can in the time I have allotted? And we explore in the book different strategies for doing this well. But for me, this is like the art I'm studying.
That's great. I think mine is sort of on the other end, which is perfect. I have a 17-year-old daughter now and a husband, and I stepped away from a lot of the consulting work that I had been doing, except for just the with one major client, to write this book and to really dive in. And this has been a 5-year deep dive and so, so wonderful. And now there's, you know, we're pulling into a different phase, shepherding the book along. But you know, what could happen is all the rushing in of that work again. And I'm not entirely sure that's the right use of me right now with my daughter as a junior, you know, here. She's only here for this much longer. And, you know, there's still lots to shepherd with the book. And so I'm trying to stay really tuned into what's the best use of me and not get busy and not fill it. So that gets confusing in terms of relationships. There's a lot of, you know, relationships I care about, and they're saying, hey, how about this? How about that? And so keeping clear on that, I can get a little noisy with myself about those relationships and obligations. I can get stuck into the habit of busy that I, you know, had before. And so I'm seeking out a lot of deeper moments with silence. So yes to the day-to-day, like Justin just described, I need that all the time. But what are some deeper dive, you know, weekend retreats I can do to really tune into what's the best deployment of me right now in this stage?
What's the longest silence practice you both have done? Just, I know we were talking about quality versus quantity, so it's kind of the opposite question, but
for me, I've done a number of 10-day silent meditation retreats. So I don't know how many. I used to do those about quarterly for a number of years, but that's not really my route so much anymore. Now I'm more inclined to do weekend retreats, and I usually do more mind expanding retreats with psychedelics and entheogenic in groups where there's a deep practice, a lot of ritual, and a great strong container. So that's my practice now.
How about you, Justin?
Yeah, I've done some 3-day retreats in the past, but we really emphasize in the book that even though we love these immersive periods of silence, like, we really don't want to recommend to anyone that they go on a deep, long silent meditation retreat if that's not their jam, you know, if that's not what resonates, because everyone can find silence in their own way. And we noticed, you know, as I mentioned before, this is a kind of non-meditator's guide to getting beyond the noise. We've noticed in some ways that, like, meditation these days is this, like, used as this cudgel with which to beat ourselves up. You know, like, we talk to people who heard about this book who are like, oh my God, I should be meditating more. I know meditation's so important, but I'm not doing it enough. And we wanted to write this book as a chance to really, like, offer some license to people to give up those thoughts, to give up those worries, because it's not necessary often to really go on a long retreat or even have a regular formal sitting meditation practice. It's just to be able to understand, like, where is there noise in your life? What's distracting you from what you really want, your clear perception, your intention, and find the ways to navigate that. You know, what does silence feel like for you? What does it really mean for you in your felt experience? You know, not just in your mind as a concept, but in your body, like, what does it feel like to be beyond the noise? and tune into that and find more of it in your life, however works for you.
Hi, friends. You guys know I am obsessed with safe, effective skincare. One of my favorite skincare brands of all time, which is USDA Certified Organic, yes, actually Certified Organic, is Purity Woods. And friends, I'm going to be completely honest here. I already had a few skincare brands that I loved when I first found Purity Woods. So I was like, okay, another skincare brand? It was going to take a lot for me to actually add something new into my routine. Oh my goodness. The second I tried Purity Woods, it became a complete non-negotiable. And when I interviewed the founder, Brian Vasily, on my podcast, that's when I learned why. Brian discovered the astounding clinically studied benefits of organic maple leaf extract for the skin. Maple leaf extract contains antioxidant and hydrating properties that help soothe irritated or inflamed skin while also helping to plump, brighten, and nourish the appearance of your skin. So we're talking skin firming, anti-aging, all the things. It's sometimes even called plant-based Botox because of how effective it is. There are three of their products that I use every single day and night of my life. That would be their age-defying dream cream, which I use, yes, during the day, their age-defying night cream, which I use at night, and their hyperlift serum, which I use both morning and night. Every time I put these products on my skin, I just have this sigh of relief. They feel that good, they smell wonderful, I see the effects of my skin, and I just love them that much. And as you know, I am neurotic about having non-toxic ingredients. These products are incredible. You could eat them, but please don't eat them. And Purity Woods has an incredible offer for you guys. You can get up to 38% off at puritywoods.com/Melanie. Turn back time on the appearance of your skin with Purity Woods Age-Defying Dream Cream. Go to puritywoods.com/Melanie at checkout for up to 38% off. That's puritywoods.com/Melanie. I am obsessed with Purity Woods and I can't wait for you guys to try it as well.
Yeah, I love that. And that definitely was a very clear message in the book. I find it really interesting, especially in like the health and wellness community, the biohacking community, because there is a big emphasis on mindfulness and meditation, which are very powerful and wonderful. But I always do find it really interesting that some people, it is like meditation specifically is, you know, what works for them. It's a game changer. And other people, it's that specific modality is just not what resonates and works for them. So this provided a much, you know, using that word expansive again, you know, more expansive approach to finding what I think in the end is a very similar goalpost. I'm curious, when you were coming up with the title, was there ever a discussion about, because you just said like the non-meditator's guide to silence or something, was there ever a discussion about maybe using something clickbaity like that for the subtitle?
There were lots of discussions.
Yeah, we thought for a while that would be the subtitle.
I figured when you said that, I was like, oh, that sounds like that was on the...
It's still our favorite unofficial title because it does get to the heart of it. And, you know, even meditators think of themselves as non-meditators because they're not meditating all the time or they're never meditating as much as they hope to. And of course, it's never meant to be exclusionary, you know, but more inclusive because silence belongs to everybody.
The concept of actual silence, like as a possibility. I thought it was so cool. You talked about this study, which also was in that Sentient book that I mentioned about the guy at Harvard who went in the silence chamber. And when he came out, he said that he heard two sounds or a sound still, and he didn't know what it was. And they said it was his nervous system, basically.
Yeah. John Cage, the composer, he heard two sounds when he went in this soundless room, one high pitch and one low pitch. And he told the engineer who was running the room. And the engineer said, oh, the room is working fine. The high pitch sound is your nervous system in operation. The low pitch sound is your blood in circulation.
That is crazy. And I think this is really important and really freeing. Because somebody might think just approaching this work that they need to find, you know, the ultimate silence. But that example, you talk about the role of vibration and how things are always in motion. It sounds like, no pun intended, actual silence. Is that actually a possibility? What about people who are deaf?
Yeah, we conclude that in a universe that is whirring and vibrating and churning and swirling, that there may not be such a thing as silence. And so we can kind of let go of that really technical, like, you know, definition, because we can't even in those anechoic chambers, like the one John Cage stepped into that day, can't really have absolute silence there. What that does is just sort of helps with the refraction of sound. It absorbs the sound in this room so that there's not extra echoes. So in this universe, yeah, maybe in some small pocket in some other universe, there's silence, but here, maybe not so much. And we kind of just embrace that and move on to the experience that we're all having, whether we're hearing or hard of hearing or deaf. What is our experience of silence?
Did you interview any people who are deaf?
We didn't. We went through down that alley when we thought we were mostly talking about auditory silence. But when we expanded to informational and internal silence, it didn't feel quite as important to hone in on that one aspect, because we were looking at all these different areas of noise. And those areas of noise are ones that are shared by all humans walking the planet, it seems, right now. So that's how we approached it. But we did definitely learn a lot from those initial interviews. You were going to add, Justin?
Yeah, I was just going to add, one of the main figures in the book is actually blind, Cyrus Habib, who describes that in his relationship to sound. And a big part of what we're describing here is really that the silence that we're talking about as the golden silence is the silence that we seek, you know, and that there are these shadow sides of silence that include the silence of censorship and oppression, which we have a whole chapter devoted to, you know, and deafness in a way we could think about as the silence that a person is not seeking. You know, and again, we're not writing about this in a way that is like all sound and stimulus is bad. Certainly not. We love sound and stimulus in our lives. We love music in our lives. And at the same time, there's something that as a society, in terms of what we value, in terms of how we've structured things, that we've come out of a balance where there can also be value within the empty space, the open space, the silence.
Listeners will have to get the book and read all about the concept of ma, which is such a cool concept. I wish we had that in our today's culture. Maybe I'll just leave that there as a teaser. So we'll have to get the book and see what that is. The other thing I was going to ask about was, you had a few studies throughout the book. They were all fascinating, but in all of them, they were accidental in the researchers discovering things about silence. So one was about the whales in the ocean and studying their stress levels and realizing that it correlated to a decline in shipping. And so it had to do with, and you can correct me if I'm wrong about any of this, but basically when there was less of the shipping, there was less sound, and that was what was ultimately correlating to their lack of stress. Was that what was happening?
Yeah, that's right. That was found after 9/11, when the shipping industry came to a screeching halt, and reaffirmed in COVID times, at the very early end of COVID times, when shipping halted, the sound of shipping stopped, and that stressor on whales, you know, was gone, and therefore the whales could hear each other, and they can do their whale songs, they could find each other, and their stress hormones were measured much, much lower for that short period of time, and then they went back up as soon as shipping returned.
So fascinating. And then a second one was a researcher studying, I think, stress and different types of music. And he had like a reset moment of silence in between them and actually realized that was having the most profound effect, the silence, not the music.
Yeah, that describes it as usually thought of as a control variable in studies. So it's just like a nothing, a neutral or something, but it ended up yielding the best results. And that was a huge study actually in cardiovascular medicine and really shifted people's perception of silence. It's actually an area of study worthy of pursuing.
And then these are just so cool. And then the third one was studying mice and the mother mice and their stress response and reaction to different sounds. And one of the sounds was like the sounds of their pups, which the researchers thought would have the most profound effect, but actually it was the silence. Although in that situation, wasn't the takeaway that the silence was actually the most stimulating for the mice's brains?
Yeah. Yeah. There was a study at Duke Medical School that looked at the effect of all these different kinds of sounds, like you mentioned. And it was the silence that stimulated the growth of neurons most in the hippocampus, which is the part of the brain that's most associated with memory. So the finding that that research team came upon was actually that the act of trying to hear in silence activates the brain and promotes neural development. So when we actually pay attention to the silence as something worthy of our attention, that can regenerate the brain. And that was something really similar to what the philosopher Pythagoras, who we talked about before, with the 5 years of silence, told his students to like absorb the silence, to go as deeply as they could into the silence. So this is like one of the key takeaways for us from the science in this book, is that there's something edifying about listening deeply to silence. And it gets back to what we talked about at the very beginning of the episode about silence is not just the absence of something, but a presence unto itself. Because it seems kind of weird to like listen to an absence. But like if we can encounter silence not just as emptiness, but as a kind of fullness, it's like something worthy of our attention. That was like the intuition we both felt in that moment when we felt some despair back in 2017 that led to this whole project. Like, listen to the silence, absorb it, and let it clarify you, let it heal you.
I've definitely, reading your book, definitely had that reframe about silence in my own life and my exposure to it. And it's so interesting because like with those studies I just mentioned, people weren't necessarily looking for that or expecting those results. I think it definitely speaks to just how much this isn't appreciated yet, like, or how we're just not looking in this aspect and how incredibly important it is. So I can't thank you guys enough for the work that you're doing. I'm sure people make jokes about this all the time, but one of my initial thoughts when I picked it up was I was like, how is this going to be an entire book about silence? Like, what are they going to talk about? I mean, it just really, really blew me away. It's definitely been one of the most, as far as like all of the books I've read, one of the most, it just really affected me reading it. So I can't thank you enough for what you're doing.
Thank you so much, Melanie. That means that's just wonderful to hear. Thank you so much for receiving it the way you did, so fully.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, thank you guys. And I can't wait for listeners to check it out. And so I know, Lee, you were talking about your future with what you're doing next in your life. Would you guys do another book or where's the path from here?
I love the idea of writing another book with Lee because just every moment of the journey was just felt so harmonious to me. Like it never really felt like work. You know, it's got to be something where like the inspiration really strikes. And I'm doing a lot of work on clean tech companies right now and working on some environmental policies and projects and new startups. So that and the kids are keeping me busy. And we're actually, our family's embarking on a little around the world trip. We're going to be taking our 2-3-year-old twins and 6-year-olds to Europe and South America for about a year. So keeping busy with stuff, you know, and working on managing to find the quiet spaces within it.
Yeah. And I'm feeling the call to continue to shepherd the book and get the word out. And I love, thank you, Justin. I feel the same. Our co-authorship has been super blessed. And yeah, I can't imagine life without Justin and this process. And it's been wonderful. I keep working with chemists who are trying to get toxic chemicals out of our products and out of our environment. So that work continues, and teaching dance and finding my silence in a loud thump and beat with a bunch of dancers around here, and then enjoying my daughter while I still have her at home. That's my plan.
I'm just I'm a fan of all of that. Well, the last question that I ask every single guest on this show, and it's just because I realize more and more each day how important mindset is. So what is something that you're grateful for?
I'm grateful for this conversation right now. And that's to say, I'm grateful for what the process of bringing this book into the world has brought in terms of these opportunities to connect. Like for us, this was such a this was such a like act of faith, a kind of bold move for us to write this book about silence. Like you just said, Melanie, like what could be a whole book on silence? Or, you know, sometimes we're like, oh, did we write too many words? Or, you know, some people say, well, shouldn't this just be a book of blank pages? So we like brought this thing into the world. And then it's like, we've been able to have these meaningful conversations, like this one that we've been able to share with you about what this means for different people and coming into this space of turning down the noise, but also this space of imagination. Like, what would it be like in this world of so much sound and stimulus if we could just connect to the presence, to the pristine attention, like imagining with other people? It's been something that's really given me a lot of feeling of happiness and gratitude.
Oh man, I feel almost weepy. Thank you for your question about gratitude, because I have, and we have so much. This process has been amazing. And to be able to attune to one another and attune to silence, and then attune to those like yourself who are interested in it, to feel that aliveness come through and to be in service to that. I am so deeply grateful for that, even that opportunity. And so to any listeners that you've helped us reach, I'm so grateful for that too, Melanie. Thank you for lending your beautiful community to this topic.
Well, thank you both so much. So for listeners, definitely get the book. And we were talking about this before the conversation, but it's available in all forms. The audiobook has a wonderful narrator that really, I think, embraces the vibe that you're trying to, create. So how can listeners best follow your work?
You can look us up at Astrea Strategies. That's A-S-T-R-E-A strategies.com. That's where Justin and I combine our forces to bring contemplation into action. And you can also learn a lot more about what we're doing in terms of media and articles and things like that on that website. And you can find our book, Golden, The Power of Silence in a World of Noise, at Amazon and independent booksellers. And like you mentioned, the Audible book with read by Prentice Oniemi is really getting a lot of praise and worthy of it, because he's just an incredible narrator who makes our words even better. And social media wise, as you might expect, we are not very active on social media, but you can find us on LinkedIn at Justin Zorn, Justin Talbot Zorn, and at Lee Mars. And we welcome your contact there.
Awesome. Well, we will put links to all of that in the show notes. And just thank you both again so much for your work, for what you're doing, you know, for having these conversations. I mean, it's really having a profound effect on so many people. And even now, I'm just realizing another layer of gratitude I can have, like, for this show and this podcast, because I was realizing, I guess these conversations on this podcast are really the one time for me that I turn off, you know, I literally don't engage in anything else except for this conversation. And now I'm just understanding more and more why that's, you know, so important. But thank you both so much. This was amazing. I will be following all of your work, and hopefully we can talk again in the future, because this was really wonderful.
Thanks, Melanie.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Melanie, for all the time and reading the book and sharing it.
You guys too have a beautiful rest of your day.
Thank you so much for listening to the Melanie Avalon Biohacking Podcast. For more information, you can check out my book, What When Wine: Lose Weight and Feel Great with Paleo-Style Meals, Intermittent Fasting, and Wine, as well as my blog, melanieavalon.com. Feel free to contact me at podcast@melanieavalon.com. And always remember, you got this.